Samantha has a kids' class, all right. Y'all better behave, Samantha. She might take after you-know-who. That'd be Charisse. I could tell. Luke chapter 18, we're going to be looking at verses 9 through 14. And before we get started, if you have an outline, you see the introduction there, a question and answer. I want to ask everyone a question. And everybody listen to me just for a minute. I ask you a question, and please do not answer aloud. All right? There's a few guilty culprits that I'm saying that to particularly. There's a big blank there if you write your answer in. I'm going to ask a question, and you'll formulate the answer in your mind fairly quickly, or you should be able to. You will. And Write it down. Shorthand, you know, it don't have to be a long answer necessarily. Here's the question. Suppose that you are sitting on a park bench, walking through Walmart, just somewhere out, and a person comes up to you, or maybe a friend. They come up to you and they ask you this question. And they said, here's the question. If you were to die right now, and you find yourself before God, and God asks you this question: why should I let you into heaven? What is your answer? Standing before God, He asks you, why should I let you into heaven? What is your answer? We're going to read our text to start with this morning, verses 9 through 14. Jesus is speaking, and he says, "And he also spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others." Here's the parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, "God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess." And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Three or four points on the outline that we want to cover. The first one is just a simple observation. That's a parable. This is a parable that Jesus gives just for some. See in verse, well, let me ask this question. Have you ever heard this phrase, "He's preaching that right at me"? Ever heard anybody say that? Have you ever thought that yourself, perhaps? All right. We know what that means. It means that he knows about my sin. It means instead of talking to me one-on-one, he's going to get at me from the pulpit. Means that he cooked this sermon up just for me. That's what it's meant by that, right? I preached my first sermon in 1983, and to my knowledge, I've never intentionally preached a sermon to somebody. There's been a lot of times that the things that I said in sermons, I knew very well applied to people out there. that's, you don't have to preach very many times to know that's unavoidable. Either God decided to hide from it or to preach your sermon. At our church, we generally, practically all the time, preach through books. And you may not be aware of this, but our texts are laid out for the next 2 or 3 months. Sometimes it may be 6 months ahead of where the divisions are going to be, who's going to be preaching this, who's going to be preaching that. And it's laid out. And if you think that we can come up with a sermon just for you at just the right time, that's probably not going to happen. There have been times, very recently, in one occasion and other times before that, where a subject came up in the book of Luke that fit someone that was here that day just like a hand in a glove. And that's just the way it falls, you know. That's just the way it happens. But as far as intentionally doing it, I don't think John does that, and I don't do that. That's not the way it is. Jesus, we see in the book of Luke and the book of John and Matthew and Mark as well, there are times when Jesus, the text says, and he turned to his disciples and said something. Primarily he was talking to his disciples. There may have been other people around that heard it, but primarily he was talking to them. There are times when it says, and he said to the Pharisees. Maybe other people heard that, but he was talking specifically to the Pharisees. There are times when it says he turned to the multitudes and said, and I'm sure multitudes there, probably everybody in the multitude may not have heard what he said, but those within the vicinity of his voice did. And he's speaking to them. But this is the only time that I can remember off the top of my head where it says he spoke this parable to a different group, to a very specific group. And what group is that? It says he spoke it to those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous. He spoke to those who, because they thought they were righteous, looked down upon others and despised other people. This is who he's speaking the parable to. And I'm sure that there were a few of them right there listening. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if they read between the lines and they knew he's talking to me. He's talking about me. Jesus tells the parable, and the parable begins, two men went to the temple to pray, a Pharisee and a tax collector. This is a parable, and I assume by that means this didn't really happen. Jesus may not have been aware of a specific instance where this happened, but then again, it very well could have happened. From what we know of the Pharisees and the tax collectors and the working of God in people's hearts. Could have happened, but it's not intended to be told as something that did happen. But he does name the group. The two men are part of a group. One is the Pharisees. So there's one group that's named. Perhaps some of them are there listening. Some people are there listening who were Pharisees. The other group is the tax collector. And perhaps there was someone there who was a tax collector. Perhaps that the odds of that may have been smaller, but in God's way of doing things, there's no such thing as odds or chance or luck or those things. So here's the beginning of the parable. Two men go to the temple to pray. One a Pharisee, one a tax collector. Then we get to verse 11. Now, there's something in this verse that you see we're fixing the cover that's the only thing that's different, that seems to be different between some versions, some translations, and others. So let's look at what I've got here. First was this, he prayed standing by himself. This is the way the English, the ESV, English Standard Version, portrays this. I think I've got the phrasing words of the words turned around, but it's talking about standing by himself. Now, what does it mean to stand by yourself? When I read that in the ESV, it sounds to me like he's saying he was over here and everybody else was over here. He was kind of by himself, wasn't anybody else around him. He's standing there by himself and praying. All right, that's what the ESV renders this. The next one is he stood and prayed to himself. This is found in the New American Standard, renders it that way. When I read that or hear those words, he stood and prayed to himself, that could be taken two different ways. One is, I use, at least in my upbringing, we use that word, if I prayed to myself, then I was quiet about it. I wasn't saying it aloud. All right, I was silent, praying to myself. All right, that's one way that the New American Standard could intend that to be taken. It also could be intended to be taken, he prayed to himself, I prayed to myself, as if I was the recipient of my prayer. All right? Perhaps that's what it means. I don't know. I can see how that could be in this case with the Pharisee, because he liked what he said about himself. And he liked to hear it. All right? Maybe that's the idea there. The next one is he stood and prayed with himself. That kind of says the same thing, just with a little more pinch to it, a little bit. The King James, the New King James, and the Revised Standard Version render that this way. He prayed with himself. All right? And then the last one, he stood and prayed about himself. All right, the NIV uses that rendering. Now, these all are a little different. Perhaps they're a little different emphasis. But the Greek language, when it interprets or translates prepositions, there can be one Greek word that can be rendered with four or five different prepositions. And here is an example of that. And each one of them, depending on which one they use, and thought would be the proper one to use, will give you a little different flavor to what is saying there. But all of them leave you with the idea that this dude's prayer is not your model prayer, right? This Pharisee's prayer leaves a little bit to be desired as far as getting past the ceiling, as we say sometimes. Now, we're fixing to take a little diversion. Has anybody in here ever been diagnosed as being colorblind? Nobody? All right. I'm going to give you a spiritual colorblind test. So, Conrad, if y'all put up that first slide. Here's a slide. And usually blue and greens are the most common colors that people get mixed up. Y'all do see that's green, right? No? Everybody say that's blue? That's blue, some flavor of blue. All right. What color is the little white box there? I didn't mean to say white. Okay, kind of has a little different hue to it there, right? Okay, go to the next slide. The big part is what color? And the little box is? White. Next slide. Green and white. Next slide. White and? Gray, green, off-white. Okay. Is it white?
No.
No. Well, you just told me for three slides it was white. Most of you did. All right. Here's the point of the diagram. The first three slides, we tended to call that little square white. Why? Because contrasted with the blue and the purple and green, white was close enough. Right? But you get to this slide, And all of a sudden, you're contrasting it with something that is white, pure white, all white, flat white, stark white, whatever you want to call it. And suddenly you can see that this is not white. Okay? Now, back to our text this morning. Who is this man, this Pharisee, comparing himself to?
Lesser men,
other men. I thank you, God, that I am not like other men. Okay, he's comparing himself to other people. Somebody else. And that's what we tend to do if we want to see the best in ourselves, isn't it? We compare ourselves to somebody else that we know I can beat that. All right, I compare myself to other men. He says, I thank you, God, that I'm not like other men. And then he gives us a couple examples of the other men that he thinks he's better than. Extortioners, the unjust, the adulterers, or even that guy over there, that tax collector. That's the Pharisee's prayer. He says, I thank God. I thank you, God. Do you think this Pharisee is sincere in his gratitude to God? I doubt it. I doubt if he's sincere about it. Of course, y'all know me, I'm judgmental to start with.
No.
All right? And when y'all go to pray, you can say, I thank you, God, I'm not judgmental like John. All right? I don't think he is sincere because he is taking credit for not being like these other men. He doesn't. It's not that he's giving God the credit that he's not like them. In his heart, I believe that he thinks he is to get the credit for not being like them. What are the things that the Pharisee does not do? According to him, he doesn't extort. He's not an adulterer. He's not unjust, which is a very broad term. To never be unjust. All right. What about the things that he does do? He fasts twice a week. All right. The Pharisees, according to the Old Testament law, as far as I am aware of, only were required to fast, I think, twice a year, as far as a requirement. But they did twice a week. And they made sure everybody knew it. They looked puny and put white ash on their face so they look pale and stricken and I guess hungry. You know, I'm not sure what they're trying to look like except like they were doing penance almost. So everyone could know when they were fasting. Someone said they tended to do it the day of had a regular days of the week, tended to do it on this one day when there was a lot of people in the marketplace and they made sure they were where a lot of people could see them fasting. They tithe of all they possess. Now that's a commendable thing. You know, the last statistic that I heard among evangelical Christians is that 2% of evangelical Christians tithe. 2%. Pharisees got us beat. All right, 2%. These lists of what they do and what they don't do are not meant to be exhaustive lists, I don't think. This is a parable, Jesus is just giving these things to make the point of his parable. But it is very common for people to depend on their good deeds or their preferred ritual to gain favor with God. That is very common. Can you think of any things that people do? They may even express that that's why they're doing it, to gain favor with God, good deeds. Somebody name one that may be used. Go to church. Go to church to try to gain favor with God. Give a little money. You know, I went to school. Dean will know this guy, too. He was a black guy that I was friends with. And occasionally, I went to church on Sunday. And talking about a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that was me. I went to church on Sunday. And this young man apparently was raised going to church. And on Sunday mornings, he was depressed. Unless we went to church. And we'd go to church, and he'd be on cloud nine, you know, for 2 or 3 hours after. Why was that? I think, I always thought even back then, it was because it made him feel good that he had done the right thing, and somehow that he was okay. Going to church is one thing that people very well can do, and I'm sure a lot of them do, just to try to gain favor with God. Arlene mentioned giving. What else? Other things? Volunteer. Volunteer for this, volunteer for that, join this club, join that club, the secret society of the moose heads or whatever, you know, that are, you know, give to better mankind, all these kind of things people do. I actually have had a guy tell me, ask him what we were out doing some evangelism stuff, ask him what he was dependent on to make him give him assurance that he was going to heaven. And just straight up, he said, my affiliation with the Masonic Lodge. And I'd been trained a little bit how to answer things, but I had never been trained to deal with that one. And I was pretty young. My affiliation with Masonic Lodge. You know, there's a church right down the road here that when I was a kid, this is being taped, but they're all dead anyway. So, when I was a kid, I think almost every deacon in that church was a Mason. And I always had the thought, even as a teenager, if push came to shove, and they had to choose between being a Mason and being a Christian, they'd be hard-pressed to figure out which way to go. They'll get irate quicker if you criticize the lodge than if you criticize scriptures. Walking down the path one day or around the block one day, I've told y'all this story, I think, as well. Ask another guy that question, standing out on the street. And, you know, how do you know that you'll go to heaven? And he said, well, I look at it like this. He said, I think God kind of grades on a curve. He grades on a curve. And everybody, you know, and I don't know the number he used, but say 5 and above, you know, goes to heaven. And if you're below a 5, you know, you don't make it. Now, who's putting this on a curve? Okay? He would tell you God is. But what is God using to place you on that curve? Other people's behavior. That's what grading on a curve is. I'm comparing myself, or God's comparing me to all of you and seeing where I need to be on the scale. All right? So, you know, I couldn't wait to ask him my next question. Where are you at on the scale? Where do you think he was? If five was the breaking point, where do you think he was?
Six, you know.
He wasn't near about going to claim to be a 9 or a 10. No, he's not that good. But he's just barely good enough to get in.
Got a lot of sixes.
Yeah, a lot of sixes. All right. Comparing ourselves to other people. Some of them become preachers. People can depend on the fact that they were preacher that they're going to go to heaven. Or become nuns. Or other things similar to that. I know several men who show a zero interest in Christianity. But on at least two occasions, in dealing with this one guy, had a financial transaction going, and I owed him some change, and it was like $20 or so. And he told me, he said, just stick it in the offering at church. He'd never been to church, or to our church. Never. He knew I was a preacher at this church. Preached here some, went here. Stick it in the offering at the church. Why did he tell me that? Again, I know I'm judgmental, but I think that he did it because it made him feel good about his standing with God. Why do people do that? Why do people trust in these little things that they make to be big things to gain favor with God? Here's why. Because it is easier than being like Jesus. It is easier to go to church than to love God. It is easier to be in a club and give money and do all these things than it is to submit yourself to the authority of the God of this universe. It's easier to do these little things that you kind of enjoy doing anyway than to submit yourself and to God, to the rule of God in your life. And they know the cost. They know what the trade-off is. They do it because their heart is stone cold, dead. They do it because they are ungenerate and have zero desire for God. It's like eating a gross food that you cannot stand. You have no desire for it, so why would you ever even think about eating? Some people can parrot all the intellectual doctrines of grace that we teach here. They can present the arguments and argue the point one way or the other and be as lost as a goose. It doesn't take intelligence alone to be a child of God. It takes regeneration. Being born again. Being born from above. A person who has not that regeneration may see. They may see and understand to some extent intellectually everything that's here. But they really don't see it. They really don't perceive it, as Jesus said. Well, that's the Pharisees' prayer. What about the tax collector's prayer? Here's a question for you. What physical features or elements describe this tax collector? First one, it says he stood afar off. What is the significance of this tax collector? When you read that in the text, it says he stood afar off. What does that matter? What does that mean? Could be killed.
Guilt.
Could be what?
Guilt.
Guilt. Oh, guilt. Is that what you said? I thought you said the Christian mafia were after him or something. Guilt. I think you're right. I think he didn't want to come very close just because he knew he didn't belong there. Something's wrong here. He's embarrassed. Humiliated. He stood afar off. What does it say? He would not lift his head or his eyes to God. Why not? Same reason. The shame of what he had done, or what his life was. He beat his breast. What's that significant about? Berate himself?
Angry
at himself? Okay. Desperation. I kind of wondered if this might be, you know, the kind of the idea of penance a little bit. You know, he's doing something to show God he's punishing himself for what is it. I'm not sure about that, but that kind of goes with this idea. What are the key elements of his prayer? Short and sweet, ain't it? Maybe not sweet. Short and bitter. Oh God, help me. Oh God, save me. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And that's the end of it. You don't hear anything about, I do this, I do that. You don't hear anything about, I'm not quite as bad as those other guys over there. None of that. I'm not as bad as that Pharisee. At least I'm not a hypocrite like he is. All right, I admit I'm a sinner. I admit I need mercy. I'm not a hypocrite. Although he's in doing so, he's naming one of his virtues. He's not a hypocrite. All right? One basic cry, God, help me. We sing a song, Rock of Ages. And I wish some group or somebody would kind of rework that song and modernize, not modernize is a better word, but change the melody of the song a little bit, at least for me, you know, just a bit for me. I mean, I like the way it is, but it just has a connotation of being wild, wild west, and that's the only song they knew, and you know, they sing Rock of Ages. But that song has some of the best theology, some of the best doctrine of any song, especially for its length. All right, one of the verses say this, could my tears forever flow? Could my zeal no languor know? Now, let's stop right there. Could my tears forever flow? What does he say? He says, if I could cry and weep in grief and in sorrow for all that I've done, if I could do it, can cry and weep forever. Forever. Or the other side of that coin, could my zeal, no languor, no. What does languor mean? Rest, to abate, to back off, to relax. Disinterest, perhaps so. All right. If he says, could my zeal, if I had such a love and such a fervor for God to serve him and worship him that it never slacked off, not even the slightest. If my tears could ever flow and my zeal could not be relaxed, not even a bit, forever. What does he say? These two things for my sin would never atone. These things for sin could not atone. You must save. Thou must save, God, and you alone. Now notice the next line. In my hand, no price I bring. I come before you, God, there's nothing I can bring. There's nothing I could bring. I couldn't even imagine what it would be that I could bring. There is nothing I can bring. I must simply cling to you and cling to the cross. Great verse in that song. Tax collector doesn't remind God of all that he's done. You think the tax collector's ever done good deeds? I'm sure he has. We all do comparatively good deeds. But he doesn't remind God about them. I doubt if he's even thinking about them. He doesn't remind everybody else about them. We like to make sure at least somebody knows our good deeds when we do them, don't we? Tell somebody. And the longer it goes, it looks like nobody knows, the more antsy we get. You know, somebody needs to know this. The tax collector's prayer, very simple, very to the point. God help me. Number four, the lesson of the parable. Jesus tells us at the end of verse 14, if you exalt yourself, you will be humbled. If you humble yourself, you will be exalted. First question is this, how do people exalt themselves? We just told a dozen or two examples, haven't we? In the process of the sermon, they exalt themselves by bragging on themselves, making sure people know what they do. We've talked a lot about that. How does a person go about humbling themselves? Putting others first. Okay. All right. I'm going to tell you honestly, I don't know. I don't know how you humble yourself. What Dan gave is an example of a person practicing humility. But for me to go about humbling myself, I might can do deeds that are show humility. But for me to set out this day to be humble, set out to this day to make myself humble, I struggle with how to do that. And perhaps it's because I'm afraid that if I do good, humble deeds, that somewhere along the line I've got to figure out how many of them's enough that I've achieved what I wanted to achieve, right? And somehow that just smells not of humility, right? I've heard two or three things over the course of my life. Let me give you an example. When I was a kid in church, we had what they call perfect attendance awards in Sunday school. Some of y'all have been there, I guess. And you get a little pin, first pin, you know, about as big as your thumbnail, and it pins on your shirt, you know, perfect attendance Sunday school. And the next year, you don't get, or at least the way I'm remembering this, you don't get a new pin, you get a little hanger thing that goes under it. You know, for the second year, and something can be hung under it for the third year, so you look like a brigadier general, you know, after about 5 years. These things hanging down and swinging on each other, you know. Now, this is in church. In church, giving awards that we can wear on our chest for our good deeds. I don't know how long they lasted, but I did remember seeing one woman wore hers, but I think most people saw through the ridiculous nature of doing that in front of people to be seen. Bitter. Been bitter about it ever since. I was very sick that week. Humility, this is a statement from me, take it or leave it, research it, think about it. Humility, I believe, is a gift from God. Is a gift from God. The next two statements are not original with me, but I think they're good. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. Humility is not thinking of yourself at all. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's not wearing ashes and then standing around in the ashes or whatever the case may be to make yourself look humble. Humility is a trait, or a person does not even think of themselves. Pride, the opposite of humility, is believing that I have achieved what really God and others have done for me. You can see that in about any discipline or any area of life. Person is a good athlete, and they're really good. And it's pretty soon, what do they think about themselves? I'm special. I'm somebody special. Did they go out and buy the ability to be a good athlete? No. They were born with it. It is nothing that they did to do that. Now, sure, they may have worked out, they may have exercised, they may have honed their skills and all this kind of stuff. But somebody else, lots of other people, had their hand in making them who they are. It can be an athlete, it can be a musician, it can be a speaker, it can be a whatever. Any job that you have, that you're, any skill that you have that you're good at, you are not the sole person who acquired that skill. Somebody else has had their hand on your life, guiding you and turning you and moving you to enable you to be able to do what you can do. Yeah, we want the recognition for it all, for it all. So, last question is this. How will you go home today? Jesus said in his parable, he says, I tell you, that man, the tax collector, went home justified rather than the other. You might want to look at your answer for our original question. Why should God let you into heaven? Beware of answers like this. I try to do my best. I try to do my best. First of all, that's just a lie. All right? You never do your best. You never even try to do your best. But to depend on trying to do your best to get you to heaven, you're on shaky ground. You're in quicksand. You're not going to make it. What if you said something like this? I live by the golden rule. Again, you're lying. You don't live by the golden rule. You might think you ought to, but you don't. Why should God let you into his heaven? Really, the answer is he shouldn't. He shouldn't. Now, that's one side of the coin, and I know you can look the other side of the coin, and I've got the righteousness of Christ and the, you know, all the theology stuff that we know is true as well. But in and of yourself, he should never let me or you in. You need him to save you. All of it, he needs.